He fixed his mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Param Brahman, who is beyond cause and effect, who manifests the three modes of material nature. Who is beyond those three modes, and who is perceived only through unfailing devotional service. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Whenever there is bhakti, there must be three things present: the devotee, the devotion, and the Lord. Without these three, bhakta, bhakti, and bhagavan, there is no meaning to the word bhakti. Kardama Muni fixed his mind on the Supreme Brahman and realized him through bhakti, or devotional service. This indicates that he fixed his mind on the personal feature of the Lord, because bhakti cannot be executed unless one has realization of the personal feature of the Absolute Truth. Gunavibhase, he who is beyond the three modes of material nature, but it is due to him that the three modes of material nature are manifested. In other words, although the material energy is an emanation of the Supreme Lord, he is not affected, as we are, by the modes of material nature. We are conditioned souls, but he is not affected, although the material nature has emanated from him. He is the supreme living entity and is never affected by Maya, but we are subordinate, minute living entities, prone to be affected by the limitations of Maya. If he is in constant contact with the Supreme Lord by devotional service, the conditioned living entity also becomes freed from the infection of Maya. This is confirmed in Bhagavad Gita, Sagunan Samatitya Itan. A person engaged in Krishna consciousness is at once liberated from the influence of the three modes of material nature. In other words, once the conditioned soul engages himself in devotional service, he also becomes liberated like the Lord. Today we are reading from Canto 3 of Srimad Bhagavatam, Chapter 24, entitled The Renunciation of Kardama Muni, Text 43. Kardama Muni, with the blessings of his dear son Kapiladev, with his beloved wife Devahuti, has entered into the forest to establish for all the world the example that the ultimate purpose of life is self-realization. Everything else is temporary. In the verse yesterday, Srila Prabhupada explained so nicely what it means to go to the forest. In this day and age, it's not very practical for people, especially in the West, even India, to just give up everything and live in the forest, wearing tree bark, eating roots, subjecting oneself to the elements. Not only that, but if you tried to do it in any of the forests, you would probably be arrested for vagrancy. Yes? For trespassing. Unless you own the forest. But that's not possible, because before you go to the forest, you have to give up all ownership of everything. So really what is being spoken about is the spirit. The spirit of entering into a sphere of life where we are exclusively depending on God. Because the nature of life in material society is we create so many artificial shelters. We depend on the telephone. We depend on our computers. We depend on the police and the fire department and the grocery stores and the clothes stores. But when you're in the forest, you only depend on God. It's very obvious that the Lord is our only shelter. You really cannot turn anywhere else. And that is knowledge. We know the story when Draupadi was in the assembly of Kurus. Duryodhana, he just wanted to do everything he possibly could to shatter the hearts of the Pandavas. So he cheated them in that dice arena with Sakuni, Amalabhakta Prabhu. He tells the story most munificently. And he took away all their wealth. He took away all their service. He took away everything. But that was not enough. He wanted to utterly shatter their hearts. So he had their wife, Draupadi, dragged into the assembly by her hair. It's horrible. And they're Kshatriyas. To protect their wife is a very, very sacred vow of their life. But they were in a helpless condition. And then Duryodhana ordered Dushasana that you strip her naked in front of everyone. Now in today's world, this would be a very fashionable thing. But at that time, to be disrobed before anyone except your husband was worse than death for a woman. Worse than death. It was too painful to even conceive in their hearts. Dushasana was a powerful warrior whose arms were stronger than many elephants. And Draupadi was just a very simple lady with a frail body. So she looked to Dhritarashtra, the king. He wouldn't do anything. She looked to Bhishma, the grandfather warrior. He looked down in shame because there was nothing he could do. She looked at her own husbands, Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Bhima, Sahadev, Nakula. They looked to the ground in utter shame. They were not able to do anything to help her. When Dushasana began to pull, she realized no one in the world could help her in this desperate situation. So she tried to help herself. It was her last resort. She held on to the sari. See, if she was wearing blue jeans or something, she wouldn't have had a chance. But because she was wearing a sari, it's a lot of material. So she was holding on to the sari. Dushasana was thousands of times stronger than her. When he was pulling, she realized she could not save herself, and none of the fallible soldiers of this world could save her. It was in that state that she realized in the core of her heart she only has one shelter, Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So in a mood of surrender, she actually let go of the cloth she was holding on to, raised her arms in the air, and cried out from her heart with great, great, intense sense of urgency. She helplessly cried, "Hey Krishna, hey Govinda." Krishna is non-different than his name. Because she helped, she cried out, taking shelter exclusively of the Lord appeared and incarnated within her sari. Dushasana pulled and pulled and pulled, but Krishna is unlimited, and therefore her sari became unlimited. Soon the whole room was full of sari material, and Dushasana was still pulling and pulling and pulling until he was utterly exhausted. There was no end to her sari. No one could see any trace of her that she did not want. In this way she was rescued, and in the process taught the world what it actually means to exclusively take shelter of the Lord. It is a state of consciousness. So this great sage, Kardama Muni, has entered into the forest to exclusively take shelter of the Lord without distractions. Now, what we consider distractions are quite opposite from what he considers distraction. We consider distractions oftentimes hardships. Too much cold, too much heat, too many mosquitoes, poison snakes crawling around, lions and tigers. Would you consider that a distraction? For Kardama Muni, that wasn't distraction. But having a nice house, having nice people helping you do all things, having nice facilities, nice food, nice clothes, for him, that is a distraction. Because it's distracting his attention away from urgently, helplessly, exclusively crying out, "Hey Krishna, hey Govinda." Janmaishwarya Shruti Shibir Edamanamanapuma. Queen Kunti prayed like this, that the four material opulences that people strive and give their lives to achieve are disqualifications for spiritual life. High birth, high education, physical beauty, and wealth. Everyone wants these things. Why are they disqualifications? Because we become proud, and that pride distracts our consciousness from really understanding that only Krishna can save me, which is the reality. A friend in need is a friend indeed. Krishna explains that he is the best well-wishing friend. In fact, he's the only real friend. Because the time of greatest need is the time of death. And who could help us at the time of death to deliver us from the cycle of suffering? Only Krishna. And those persons who help us to know and love Krishna. So Kardama Muni was going into the forest to be free from distractions. Because lions and tigers are not distractions. And poisonous cobras are not distractions. And freezing cold and burning heat are not distractions. Why? Because in that situation, there's nowhere to go. You can't turn on the thermostat. There's no what else to do. They're not distraction because in that situation, you just have to cry out for Krishna. You have to depend on Krishna. And distraction means what takes our mind away from that state of consciousness, Krishna consciousness. Now, actual grihastha life means to create an environment in our home where we're cultivating this exclusive dependence on Krishna. Bhaktivinoda Thakur had a nice house. We have seen in Godram Dweep, if you have seen his house there, very nice house. And he had 10 children and a wife, Bhagavati, who was very, very devotional, very wonderful lady. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur has revealed to the world in one of his beautiful prayers that when I come home from my work, he was a magistrate in the British courts. He said, when I come home, I see my whole home transformed into Goloka Vrindavan, the highest planet of the spiritual world. How is that possible? Because the family is cultivating devotion to Krishna, dependence on Krishna. They're chanting the names of the Lord. They're hearing the glories of the Lord. They're serving the devotees of the Lord. So Kardama Muni's entrance, the spirit of his entrance into the forest, is a very, very important example for all of us to follow, whoever we may be, to actually cultivate and develop as a priority in our life the sincere devotion, dependence on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Because actually everything else is an illusion. Illusion means it's just not right. It's not true. Maya means that which is not. This is translation. Now the world exists. The world is not an illusion. And this body exists. And the people of this world exist. And we exist. But for the soul to identify that I am this body, and all the designations pertaining to this body are me, and all the things that I'm trying to acquire in relation to this body are mine, that is an illusion. Because actually nothing is ours. Bhoktaram jagatapasam sarvalokamaheshwaram suhridam sarvabhutanam gyatvamam shantimrachchati. If we want to achieve peace, we must realize everything is the property of God. If we are the proprietor, then no one could take anything away from us. We have control. Proprietorship means control. Ultimately, at any moment in life, and inevitably at death, everything is taken away from us. By time. Krishna reveals in Gita that he is time. But still everything looks, everything appears in a different way from what it is. Could I tell you a nice little story? Actually, you might not even think it's nice. And it might end up not so little also. But... but it's a personal experience that we had just recently. There's a very nice temple in Italy, about an hour from Venice, Venezia. It is called Prabhupada Desh. It's a very ancient stone building. Have you been, Suvasra? It used to be, it's about a 400-year old building. It was a convent. It was a monastery for renounced ladies of the Catholic faith for many, many years. And somehow or other, it was given to devotees, and it became Prabhupada Desh. It's a very nice temple. So just this year, in August, for Balaram's appearance day, there was a wonderful festival that was called. I think about 300-400 devotees from all over the European area came, from Croatia, from Italy, all over, from Germany, from England, from Russia, Serbia, from Belgium, Amsterdam, many devotees came. And there was Sachinandan Maharaj and Bhakti Vigyan Goswami Maharaj, Matsyavatar Prabhu, Mahaduti from London, and many devotees were there. Now, it happened that the days, it was a 3-day festival. The days of this festival were the record-breaking hottest days in over 100 years in Italy. It was like between 105 and 110 degrees every day. It was very hot. And on Balaram's appearance day, they asked me to give class, and I really tortured the devotees. They had to sit a long time listening to this class. And they were praying to Balaram for spiritual strength to get through it. It was a very nice festival, very ecstatic festival. The last day was a Harinam Sankirtan in Venice. It's one of the most incredible places to perform Harinam Kirtan in all the world. Have any of you ever done Nam Sankirtan in Venice? Well, first of all, we all arrived and they got a big boat. Should I continue this story? They had a big boat that fit all of us. And we just had Kirtan in the boat sailing through the sea until we came to one very, very nice place in Venice where we all came off. And then we were dancing and chanting along the little pathways. Nice thing about Venice is there is no traffic because no cars are allowed. The only traffic is boats. They have taxi boats, bus boats, individual boats, and they just drop you off right at your house, and your house is usually right on the canal. And there's tourists from all over the world just going all around. So we were dancing. It was ecstatic kirtan. Really, it's incredible. Devotees were dancing, singing so devotionally, and hundreds of people were gathering around wherever we stopped. This went on for hours. And it was over 105 degrees. Pretty low. So devotees were ecstatically hot. And then we came to one of the most famous architectural masterpieces in the world, Piazza San Marco. It's a huge square, gigantic square. And there's beautiful ancient stone-carved cathedral and then assembly houses all around this square. There were thousands of people from all over the world. We had kirtan there for well over an hour. So this kirtan went on for probably 5 hours in blistering heat. Sun started setting, and there was a boat waiting for us right near Piazza di San Marco. And we got on this boat and had kirtan. It took us to an island. Very, very beautiful island. And it was announced that we were all going to bathe in the sea. Now, can you imagine after 5 hours of chanting and dancing in 105 degree weather, how inviting that is to bathe in the sea? What do you think? And after that would be prasad on the seashore of this very beautiful island. It took about half hour of boat ride to get to the island. Then we had to do about another half hour of kirtan through the villages to get to the seashore. By the time we got to the seashore, it was night. The moon was rising. That's the beach. It was like a California beach. Very beautiful. Wide sand. And the full moon, because it was just the day after the full moon of Balaramji's appearance, the full moon was just rising from the sea. It was one of the most beautiful scenes that we had ever seen. The sea just looked so peaceful. It wasn't like in California where waves just crush you and bash you. And if you're not a surfer, it's not very compatible. It was just a very tranquil sea as the waves were going, like dancing. And the moonbeams, in the dark of the night, the moonbeams were literally glistening and dancing on the waves of the sea. Oh, it was so beautiful. And the stars were in the sky. The devotees were so much anticipating bathing in the sea. And then we felt the water. It was the ultimate perfect temperature. I mean, if you were to requisition Varuna for a particular temperature, this is what you would get. It was slightly cool. The kind of water, just kind of warm but slightly cool. You could just be in it for all day long and just be refreshed. Not too cold, not too warm. It was perfect. Devotees put on the ladies were on one side, the men were on another side. And everyone was just, oh, how beautiful, how wonderful, how nice. And in that moonlit night, in the tranquil sea, we entered into the blessed waters. As we were all going deeper and deeper, one could hear, I didn't go in yet. I was just, what's going on here, you know? People go, ah! Ah! But still, the warm water was so nice. Temperature was so beautiful that I just went in deeper and deeper and deeper. And everybody was screaming. What happened was every single person got bit by jellyfish. Everyone. Very well. Have any of you ever been bit by jellyfish? It's really painful. It just burns. People were screaming. And some people who were not yet in, they were just up to their feet feeling the nice warm waters. People were saying, don't come in, don't come in. There's jellyfish here. They call them something like medusas. Medusas is Italian for the kind of jellyfish it was. You couldn't see them. They weren't on the surface. They were underneath. And the people who were coming, you know, it felt so good. They couldn't not go in. Even though people, there's jellyfish, don't come in. Still they came in. They were thinking, you know, not me. I won't get to this. This is too nice. And a few seconds later, ah! Was incredible. The most incredible thing, I was observing. Not only was observing, but I was participating. Is all these people were getting just stung by man-o-war, jellyfish, whatever they were, and still they wouldn't get out because it was so nice. It was so refreshing. They were anticipating. They were looking forward to this bath for so long. We all had fixed in our mind this nice bath and how nice it would be. And then when we saw the scene and we felt the water, that just went deeper and deeper into our hearts. And now we were being stung by these fish and bitten, and it was burning and it was painful. We didn't want to get out. Because we just had this mental conception that I've been looking forward to it so many hours. I can't just get out now. Have any of you ever had this experience before? You anticipate something, even if it goes, you still can't give up the idea. So finally we came out, and people had these big scars on their bodies and big welts and there were some Gurukulis. Ritadvaja Maharaj, he came with his band of Gurukulis, and they actually had you know, the what are those called in the jellyfishes?
The tentacles.
They actually had the tentacles stuck to their bodies. Just stuck. And they were peeling them off. And oh, was it painful. Many people were like just peeling tentacles off their bodies, and just underneath was just bright red irritations, itching like anything. Then we sat down to take prasad. That's the end of the story. Should I tell you the purport? The purport was Krishna was revealing very clearly what is Maya? What is the world? Bhava Sagar. This is called the material, the ocean of material existence. Yes, the material existence is compared to an ocean. This ocean, to all of our senses, sometimes just appears so pleasing. Oh, beautiful moonlight, perfect temperature, nice soothing ocean breeze, perfect temperature, water, tranquil sea, no waves. Everything was perfect. Plus we're hot. We're just really hot, and we're tired, and we need relief desperately, and this is the most inviting possible situation ever. Material nature is just presenting herself to us in such a seductive, tempting, and satisfying way, giving us all promises for happiness. And that's all we see, that's all we feel, that's all we taste, that's all we hear. But there's something you don't see. That is, you don't see that in the sea are jellyfish. And they're there waiting to attack you and cause you misery. Hare Krishna. It is a fact. Any time Maya Devi tempts us with some pleasure, we should know that beneath the surface is jellyfish. They're going to sting us. And this is, my purport is a purport to a verse in Bhagavad Gita. Yehi samsparashacha bhoga dukha jonaya evate adyanta vanta konteya nate shuramate buddha. It's a very ecstatic verse. It's also depressing. If you want to enjoy this world, it's a depressing. If you want to transcend the world, it's ecstatic. Krishna says in Gita, an intelligent person does not take part in the sources of misery, which are born of the senses in contact with their objects. Such pleasures have a beginning and an end, and therefore an intelligent person does not take part in them. Within the sea are fish. Yes, so many fish. Now a good fisherman, how does he catch fish? He just doesn't throw a hook in for them and think that the fish are just going to be enthusiastic to eat the hook. Huh? He puts, what is it called? Bait? I know some of you know about fishing, obviously. You put bait. Huh? And what is bait? It's what the fish likes the best. Yes? You have to, fishermen actually have to have some, understand the psychology of fish. What will seduce the fish best? What will agitate the fish's senses the most? That's what I'm going to put on the hook. Then they will be impelled to eat it, enjoy it, and swallow it. Yes, well, Maya Devi, through the three modes of material nature, she is conducting all the affairs of the material existence. She knows everyone's psychology perfectly. Yes? So the fish is just swimming around, and there's very nice what worm. And that worm is just moving around very nicely. You don't see the hook, you just see worm like and the fish becomes very much passionate to enjoy. The senses are disrupted. It just looks like such an innocent object to enjoy. Now there may be another fish who says, Prabhu, there's a hook in that worm, don't eat it. But the foolish fish, you're a fanatic. Don't be such a fanatic. You know, we have to have a balanced life. Some enjoyment is necessary. I know, renunciation and all of this and four regulative principles, but still, we have to enjoy something. Otherwise, how will we? Don't be a fanatic. So the worm is looking very nice, and then the fish eats the worm. Now, a good fisherman never just immediately takes it, because then it'll just go right out of its mouth. Yes? If you just enjoy something, and then you immediately suffer, you don't get attached to it. And if you don't get attached to something, then you don't get trapped by it. Yes? It's really attachment that traps you. So the fisherman is very wise. He just lets the fish eat it, and eat it, and enjoy it, and chew it, and swallow it, and swallow it, and swallow it. And the fish is probably thinking about his god brother or god sister. You see, they're warned about, there's no problem, I'm enjoying it, no problem. Similarly, we engage in some kind of activity. See, I'm still chanting, I still have a sikha, I still wear a sari, I still have tilak, it's not so bad. And it goes deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper until it's deep. Then the fisherman goes, and then the fish realizes, I am trapped. That is the way Bhagavad Gita describes. From the very beginning, we should understand that the temporary pleasures of the senses for the objects are sources of misery. Although they look so wonderful, they look so harmless on the surface, but beneath the surface are countless jellyfish. Krishna tells in Gita, this divine energy of Maya is very difficult to overcome. There's only one possibility. Those who take shelter of me can easily cross beyond it. Param drisvani vartate. Because anandamayobhyashat, we're pleasure-seeking living entities. We must have happiness. We must have pleasure. It's the very nature of the soul. Krishna consciousness means the art of learning how to find pleasure in such a way that it liberates us from suffering and actually gives eternal joy to our very essence. Our soul, who we are. We can give up lower things if we accept higher things. Just like Prabhupada says, if you're eating puffed rice, if someone gives you halava, you can easily put aside the puffed rice. Yes? But for a hog, if you give him halava, he will say, no, give me stool. That is conditioning. That is conditioning. But human life is to develop higher taste by chanting, by dancing, by taking prasad, by associating with good people, by seeing the beauty of the deities, by living with an objective, with an ideal that's satisfying to the heart, serving God.
we actually find the greatest fulfillment and happiness in life. Instead of bathing in the bhava-sagar, the ocean of material existence, which is filled with countless jellyfishes and sharks and barracudas and all other living beings, we want to bathe in the bhakti-rasamrita-sindhu, in the nectarine ocean of pure love of God. We want to dive deeply into that ocean of love of God. Hey Krishna, Karuna Sindhu. Krishna is an ocean of kindness, an ocean of mercy, an ocean of love. We want to dive deeply with our entire being in taking shelter of that ocean, where there are no jellyfish, where we are embraced by Krishna at every moment, His loving grace. So that is our choice. There is the ocean of material existence and there is the ocean of spiritual love. And in this human form of life, the Jivatma has the independent free will to decide which ocean we want to swim in. We are so conditioned and perpetually bathing in this ocean, and even though the jellyfish are stinging us still, we're just thinking, oh, it's so warm and it's so nice and the moonlight is so good, ah! And the waves are so delightful, ah! and the stars are so nice, ah! And then there's whole philosophies that enjoy, there can't really be enjoyment unless there's suffering, so suffering is good. Helps us enjoy better when there's no suffering. Yes? That is the ocean of material existence and ultimately death, the ocean of birth and death. But we have the choice at every moment to dive deeply and swim in the ocean of loving rasas, loving mellows with Krishna. By always remembering Krishna and never forgetting Krishna, by learning to exclusively take shelter of that ocean, the process of bhakti. Herein, Srila Prabhupada is explaining, for there to be real bhakti, there must be three elements, and they must all be understood to be eternal. That is bhakti bhakta bhagavan. The devotee, the process of devotion, and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now those who are transcendentalists of the impersonalistic school, yes, they believe in bhakti, bhakta, and bhagavan. Many of them, actually, that is the path that they follow. They believe that there's karma yoga, and there's jnana yoga, and there's astanga yoga, and there's bhakti yoga, and any of them is good. If you follow any of them sincerely, attentively, then you could transcend the modes of material nature. You could go beyond material bondage, and ultimately you can enter into the Supreme Brahman. Their idea of Krishna, Krishna's name, or for that, Ram's name, Hanuman's name, all the various names of God, the forms of God, the pastimes of God, the characteristics and qualities of God, they are all in the mode of goodness. The impersonal, formless, activityless, absolute Brahman enters into material existence and takes a form in the mode of goodness. Assumes a name in the mode of goodness, performs leelas or pastimes in the mode of goodness. And by concentrating, worshiping, and even chanting, even Maha Mantra, chanting Maha Mantra, some of the transcendentalists of the school, their mantra is the Maha Mantra. And their Ishtadeva is Krishna, sometimes even Radha and Krishna, or Sitaram. Shiva Parvati. And they worship. I'll never forget. Can I tell you another story? You don't mind. I was living in a place called Mithila. Mithila is the birthplace of Sita, the consort of Sri Ramchandra. And I was there at the time of Ram Navami. This is back in 1972. And I had already come from Vrindavan, so I was a devotee of Radharani and Krishna. So I met this one sadhu. He was the only sadhu who was close to my age. Almost everyone I lived with and traveled with, I was 19 or 20, and they were usually in their 60s or 70s, or sometimes 80s. So this person was like about 28. So he was the closest thing to my age of sadhus I met in years. And he had such devotion. We'd go before the deities of Ram, Sita, Lakshman, Hanuman, and he would just be praying, and he would be crying, and he would just be and during kirtans he would just be absorbed in chanting, just crying out the names of Ram. And during katas he would just be absorbed, and he would be sometimes even just absorbed, just emotionally absorbed in hearing the katha. So I was thinking, I'm going to stay close to this person. I want some of what this person has. This person has very deep spiritual emotions. I should continue. So there was a feast at the Ram Mandir. And we're sitting in the courtyard of Ram Mandir. In Mithila, there's two very famous temples, Janaki Mandir and Ram Mandir. So we're sitting in courtyard with sadhus. These kind of feasts, only sadhus are allowed. If you're not sadhu, you have to go somewhere else. This is for Naga Babas and very staunch sadhus. So somehow they thought I was like that. So I was sitting there and my friend was with me. And we were taking prasad. It was nice prasad, actually. I still remember the preparations, but I won't get into details. And we, after taking the prasad, we were about to get up, and my companion looked at me and said, "Do you know why I'm constantly hearing and chanting the glories of Ram with such intensity?" I said, "Please tell me. Will you please tell me?" I really thought I was going to become enlightened. He was going to reveal the inner secret of his heart to me. And he did. He revealed the inner secret of his heart to me. He said, "I am doing this because by doing this I will become purified. And then I will become Ram." I said, "You'll become Ram? What do you mean?" He said, "Ultimately, Ram is an illusion. Ultimately, I will enter into the impersonal, all-pervading Brahman, which is Ram, and then I become God." I started feeling some indigestion when he said that, because it was, we want to love Krishna, we don't want to be Krishna. So yes, bhakti, he understood the elements. Bhakti, bhakta, bhagavan. But the difference is, a devotee understands that these three principles are eternal. This was the first teaching of Lord Chaitanya to Sanatan Goswami. He explained such deep, profound, philosophical, scientific teachings to Sanatana Goswami. But the very beginning was Jivera Swarupoi Krishnera Nityadas, that we're all eternally servants of Krishna. The devotee is eternal. The process of devotion is eternal. And the Supreme Lord is eternal. Achintya Beda Beda Tattva. In order to understand the eternality of relationship between the Lord and his devotee, and the medium of our relationship, which is pure love. Unless we understand the eternality, we can't enter into the Leela of the Lord, the transcendental mellows of divine love or ras of the Lord. So it is very, very important. If we truly want to be delivered from this ocean of material existence, we must understand that Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead in all of His divine incarnations, they are above and beyond the three modes of material nature. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anandira Dhir Govinda Sarva Karana Karana. Krishna is the Supreme Lord of all lords. Ishvara Parama. We are all Ishwaras. We all have some control over something or someone. But Krishna is Ishvara Parama, the Supreme. And His body, His form, His pastimes, His name, they are eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. We are eternally persons and Krishna is eternally person. Bhakti Bhakta Bhagavan. And if we have this consciousness, if we have this understanding, then we can quickly attain supreme destination when we chant His holy names in the mood of Draupadi, depending on the shelter of the Lord in His name. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama. So when you get bit by jellyfish, don't just go, go, Hare Krishna. And you will be delivered. Thank you very much. Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.